hit it.
All right. Coming in clean for the big 4-0 mark. Today we're talking about why you should let your kids play Fortnite, the problem with counting your NoFap streak, according to the YouTube commenters, the real power of hip-hop, according to Zuby, the pros and cons of productive procrastination, and why YouTuber Destiny believes that no college major is useless.
I got something interesting I wanted to talk about, too. A new game-changing productivity matrix. Ooh. Now on Man vs. World. Welcome, everybody, to Man vs. World. I am your host, Mark Kwepit, anti-escapism coach extraordinaire, and I am joined today by my far less hairful, far more hairless, Pete. How's it going, man?
Going great. How are you, man?
I'm doing good. Bald move going hardcore buzz cut in the winter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you gotta, I didn't anticipate.
It's colder than you think, isn't it?
Yeah, it's cold.
You got to become a hat man now.
Yeah, I do. Be like Tim Pool.
No, I'm gonna make you sign something contractually that you're not gonna just be a beanie guy.
No beanies.
Nah. Beanies are okay, but
I like this one. My mom made me this one.
She made it for you? Oh, yeah. That's pretty good. That's not bad.
Yeah, it sticks my head though. I'll pull it off. There'll be fuzz on it.
Dude, that's the thing. Is it like it comes like your hair becomes like this like Brillo pad thing?
Yeah, funny.
My hair's starting to get pretty wild. It's like, do I double down and go like full out, or do I, you know, it's kind of like in the awkward stage where it's kind of just like I got like this like Jimmy Neutron quiff going on, and it's like it's I don't know look. If you guys, it's like it gets curly at the top, but it's not curly at the sides, so it just like gets straight here and just becomes an afro on the top, which is very strange. I'm trying to see if I can figure out a way to work it, but we might be going short here soon. I might be joining you. So. Anyway, we got some cool stuff to get into today, and I wanted to talk to you guys a little bit about an idea that I've been playing with that has been pretty big for me. And I mentioned, you know, points of it in the daily email, which if you're not getting, make sure you get it. Go to markkwepit.com, sign up, get on the daily mailer, because I put a decent amount of effort into putting out something useful to you guys every day. A lot of you read on it. Our, you know, open rates are incredibly high for the audience that we have, like just compared to what other people get. So it means you guys must at least be looking at it. And I know a lot of you guys do like it. So check that out. But I'm going to go a little bit deeper in it today. And what it is a productivity matrix. Now, some of you might be familiar with this idea from Stephen Covey. And maybe in post we can put this up, like Stephen Covey's productivity matrix of urgent versus important, you know, work. But I've taken this idea and taken it a little bit further. In part, it was inspired by some of the work of Perry Marshall. I don't want to claim like I built this entirely on my own. He's got kind of his own thing, which is sort of like this, but I'm taking it a step further. And the way we do it, like the way we make a matrix is just get a, you know, box. It's like we got two axes, all right? And the two axes that we are dealing with here is the offense-defense axis, and then the intuitive versus the logical axis. And learning how these break down in terms of productivity in your life has been really eye-opening to me, because I think most of us, we over-focus on one quadrant of productivity, and that just leaves us completely flat. It screws us over, and I've failed on this in like every way possible. And I'm realizing now that like that I have these categories, I can very easily see if I'm cruising for a burnout, where, you know, I'm overloading myself or something, or I'm cruising for a stall out where I just run out of like motivation and steam, because I just don't like what I'm doing, etc. So let me start by breaking down like what these different axes are. So the first one is the offense versus defense category. So the way I see it is like we've got a lot of stuff we got to get done when it comes to productivity. Everybody's got like everything from basic home life chores to kind of like routine work with their job. And then they've got, you know, the things that would really move the needle on their high level long term goals. Right. And the question is like, well, how do we do it all? Right. Well, the first thing is to be able to separate out what's what. And that's what I do with offensive versus defensive. What I would call defensive work is any sort of productive action that keeps something that's already in motion in motion. So this is anytime you are doing something that keeps a currently established thing going, you're playing defense. So me showing up doing the show is playing defense, all right? Because Man vs. World show, it's our weekly show, and you know that's what it is. Me writing my daily emails, that's defensive work. Working with clients, okay, that's also defensive work. Also, you know, any kind of home chores and stuff like that that I have would also consider that defense because it keeps the, you know, the house running, you know, same with the admin stuff. Now, offensive work, that's like that high level stuff that actually breaks new territory. It opens up new opportunities. So this would be the things like, you know, starting to brainstorm a new business idea. For me, it would be making maybe a new marketing funnel. Or, you know, planning out my, like the yearly plan for Self-Mastery Club or something like that, okay? Like these are the things that are unique, one-off projects that hopefully unlock maybe a new realm of, a new domain of influence, new sphere of influence. And these offensive things can turn into things that you eventually defend through routine work, but it's like these are your conquering sort of behaviors, okay? So that's offense and defense. Then we've got intuitive work versus logical work. So logical work is what we're all familiar with. It's kind of like to-do list items. But intuitive work operates more on the emotional plane. There's less certainty about what the end result is supposed to look like. You're kind of going into some sort of chaos, and you're hoping to establish some sort of order there from it, but it's not 100% clear ahead of time of what that's really supposed to look like. And so if we're going to break this down, we get four quadrants. And so the first one would be intuitive plus defensive work. This is what I would consider to be like inner work, like daily inner work. It's like defensive intuitive work is like when you are maintaining your mindset, you're maintaining your emotional state. And so practically for me, that amounts to journaling. It means scanning myself and looking to make sure that I am processing any sort of, you know, fears, doubts, worries, stressors that are coming up inside of me. And what you do is you just kind of sit down with your journal and you look and see, is there any kind of hooks pulling on me, any sort of emotional things that are bothering me? And if you don't do this kind of work, because a lot of people neglect this kind of work, you're going to get off balance, right? This is the kind of stuff I have to teach my guys when it comes to quitting porn a lot of times, because they don't do emotional processing. They're focused on all this, you know, logical stuff of like to-do list items and goals and that sort of thing that they don't account for. Oh, you know, my wife said that mean thing to me and it's been really bothering me. Or, oh, I failed to get this promotion and now I'm really upset, or this girl rejected me or whatever. And then that stuff festers and then it leads to some sort of uncontrolled outburst where they, you know, sabotage their success by, you know, watching porn, going on some kind of escapism bender, etc. So making space for intuitive defensive work to keep your psychological state steady, I think, is absolutely essential. Okay. You need to have a time and a place for that. For me, I've got a morning and an evening slot, and sometimes even a midday slot for it. So the next one is, instead of intuitive and defensive, we want logical and defensive. This is our routine work that I was kind of describing. So that's the stuff I was saying. It's like me making these videos, doing admin work, you know, that kind of stuff. Anything you're doing that keeps the ball rolling, you know, you doing your 9 to 5, you taking out the trash. It's important stuff. It's got to get done. And big stuff can happen from this. You can get, you know, if you're doing it right, there can be compound interest that accrues from these kinds of things. Like, you know, if we keep showing up and doing this podcast, you know, every once in a while, we'll get a clip or something that goes viral. And that's great. But it's rare that you're going to get the exponential growth from these kinds of things. It can happen, but it's usually not going to happen all on its own. And so this is where you need to start moving into the offensive realm, all right? And so if we look to logical offensive work, this is stuff that everyone's kind of familiar with. This is like your high-level, most important tasks. So for me right now is we're getting a new sales video up, you know, that hopefully we can run paid traffic to, and it can get people, you know, buying and getting brought into our kind of like, you know, world here, the Self-Mastery Club ecosystem, more efficiently, effectively, and that sort of thing. Okay. For you, it might be exploring different kinds of, probably not exploring. It'd probably be more like you're going to study for this big test that you got coming up that'll give you an upgrade in your career. You know, I know a lot of guys, they have like these professional certifications they need to get in order to unlock a new rung in their profession or whatever. Okay, that's the kind of stuff that usually takes a lot of work. It's hard. And ideally, with this kind of work, you are lasering it down one at a time, okay? Like you are very strict with how much logical and offensive work you are doing. If you are keeping that really clear and only taking, you know, one chunk at a time, then you can just take down these top level goals while putting a bunch of energy in like your routine work. So it's like making big high level progress while keeping your current system stable. And then this brings us to the intuitive and offensive work, which is, I think, where the real magic's at. This is the thing that most guys, I think, neglect. And the more you neglect this, the more you're really hamstringing your power. Because it seems on the surface like the least valuable of all of these kinds of work, but in my estimation, it might be the most powerful. And what I've come to describe this as is like vibe surfing. Okay. That's my name for it now. I got to probably come up with a better name for it. But what you're doing is you're sitting down and you're saying, all right, I'm going to be productive right now. I'm not going to be scrolling the internet. I'm not going to be playing video games. I'm not going to be distracting myself with some bullshit. Instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to allow my mind to ponder the questions, the passions, the challenges of my life, and then just explore. Just see what comes up, okay? And what I've found is that when I create space to do this kind of work, I find huge breakthroughs, right? Like, that's literally how I came up with this idea here. This is how I mapped it out, because I was doing this and I was sitting down and I was just like, you know, there's something here. I'm realizing there's like, you know, all these different kinds of productivity, and I just started playing around with it. And I was like, oh, well, we could separate it into offense, we can separate it into defense, and then we can put it into intuitive, and then we can put it into logical. And when you do this, like, it's kind of like you're just following your muse. You're just surfing that thread of curiosity and interest. And what's cool about this is that a lot of times we don't know what we want the most, and we have to almost stumble across it serendipitously. And sometimes life will create the circumstances for you to stumble across this serendipitously, but if you create space for it, you're going to get far more of those serendipitous moments. And so the way I have it set up is like in this kind of morning and evening sort of journaling time, if I'm doing relatively okay, I don't have any defensive intuitive work to do, I don't have any emotional processing to do, instead I give myself the permission to just dream, to scheme, to play around with stuff, to explore, you know, niche ideas. And this is where I think you're going to find all your best business ideas. This is where you're going to find your personal breakthroughs. This is where you're going to find your hobbies. This is where you're going to find your unique insights on your current situation and where you want to go next. I just think most guys, they don't ever do this, because they just think that, if I got this downtime, I might as well just do what's going to be most stimulating, which is going to be video games or surf the internet or, you know, whatever. But really, giving yourself this kind of intuitive space to think about what could really move the needle in your life, you're going to find all sorts of treasures in there. So, Pete, what do you think of this? Does this make sense to you?
Yeah, I like it. You know, it's hard to make time for that, I find, at least. So I'm wondering how you do that, because I know you're a busy guy.
it's realizing that it's fun, frankly. It's like, it's instead of like other kinds of recreational downtime, like me just like letting myself just sit and vibe out, just like think about the things that I want, think about my dreams, think about potentials and stuff like that. It's exciting because you come up with all kinds of really cool ideas. And sometimes what you'll find is, you know, a problem, like you can give yourself permission to slow down and approach a problem from a completely different angle. Kind of like you create this moonshot scenario where it's like, well, what if I just took like a really crazy chance here? It's kind of like this is where your like mad scientist laboratory exists. And everybody's going to need this to different degrees, depending upon who they are, what their goals are, and what kind of person they are. For me, I'm like a, you know, I'm a very creative person. That's like what I love to do. And so for me, this kind of work is actually really fun and interesting. For other people, maybe not so much, but I still think that if you give yourself permission to just play around with wild ideas, interests, passions, musings, and you just give your space to write it out, explore it, click around, write some stuff down, and you do this regularly, you will find all kinds of hidden treasures. I think that, what is it, Perry Marshall, he refers to this, he doesn't define it as explicitly as I do here. He calls it more Renaissance time, where it's like you can spend time in prayer, you can journal, you can, you know, follow an interest or whatever. Yeah, I think this is indispensable. And if you do not try and balance these quadrants, then something's going to get out of whack. Like if you go all like the desire of the hardcore rise and grind kind of guys is they want to be putting as much energy into that offensive logical work as possible, just like nailing down those super top level goals nonstop, blah blah blah. And like, yeah, of course you want to be putting as much energy into that as you can, but if you don't take care of the stuff that's currently going in your life, you don't play any defense, well, your emotions are going to collapse or your systems around you are going to collapse. So you need to be playing some defense. And if you are only working so laser focused on like one area of like supreme clarity, then you're definitely like just not going to get surprised. You're going to be cutting yourself off from so much other creative opportunity that can float into your world. Now, there's got to be a balance. There's got to be a tension here so that you're not constantly, you know, chasing the next shiny thing like a squirrel. But if you do have this imbalance, I believe that this is the optimum state of productivity where you're going to be stable, you're going to be keeping your, you know, stable emotionally, you're going to be stable in your current lifestyle, you're going to be making progress toward your high-level goals, and you're going to be unlocking what those high-level goals are and how you can actually get there in unique and faster and more compelling ways. So, yeah, I'd love for you guys to try this concept out. You know, create some space. See what happens if you give yourself permission to really just like vibe out in a productive manner, and I'm curious what comes up for you.
Right on. All right, well, the next thing I wanted to talk about is there's been some further disagreement regarding tracking PMO free streaks. And
yeah,
so
we talked about this last time where I was saying, like, yeah, don't like not tracking your streak is dumb, basically. But then we got some pushback. So what do you say? He says, hey, Mark, casual listener here. I have to disagree with you about counting. When I counted, all I ever felt was like a complete failure after a relapse. He's talking particularly around quitting porn. And as if I was back at square one again. Counting gives us the illusion that time alone is what determines our recovery. Once I let counting go, my days without relapse grew longer as I got out of the one day at a time mindset. I like to think of it as someone who is determined to become a millionaire. If you spend every day checking your bank account, all it will do is give you performance anxiety. If, on the other hand, you start to put in long work days and don't let yourself rest until you pass out on the couch from exhaustion, you're much more likely to achieve the goal. This makes sense to me, at least. Okay, so that's pretty much the gist of the comment. And I got to disagree with this, man. And I think that most people who have actually succeeded would disagree with this. Like there's this, it's pretty standard. Like if we're just going to look at it from a business perspective, that you got to be tracking what they call KPIs. Okay. what are those, what's that stand for? Key
performance indicator.
Performance indicators. That's right. So it's like, if you're not looking at your KPIs, like key performance indicators might be sales, clicks, click-through rate, stuff like that, well, you're not going to be able to respond to trends. Bottom line, you're not going to be able to say, oh, I've been doing this, but my views went up, but my clicks and sales went down. What does that mean? If you're not looking at that, you're never even going to be able to ask that question, okay? So from a business perspective, this is, I mean, it's generally horrible advice to not track stuff. You have to, if you really want to maximize money, you want to become a millionaire, you want to look at the numbers because the numbers will tell you what the most efficient path to becoming a millionaire will be, usually. If you just, if you put in a lot of effort, that's great, but if you're not putting in the right effort, then you're not going to get anywhere. Even if you're putting in really, really hard effort, there's plenty of people out in the world who work super freaking hard and they make minimum wage, okay? And so it's like you want to up the income, you got to be looking at the right numbers and try to constantly be asking yourself with those numbers, because that's what they are. They're like ways to ask yourself questions of how can I shift this? How can I make this number go up? What did I do to make this number go down? Okay. So just practically speaking, I think that's wrong. But let's talk about the emotional component, because I think that's probably where most guys come from, is that this idea of like, oh, if I track my streak for quitting porn and it, you know, I relapse, well, that's just, it just makes me upset. It makes me mad at myself. It just makes me ashamed, and that's not helpful. It's like, well, if you're looking at it and it's making you feel that way, yeah, I would agree. That isn't helpful. But the problem isn't the tracking. The problem is your mindset. It's the way that you're processing the data that you're looking at. So, for example, if you relapse, all right, you can look at it as, oh, this is an indicator that I suck. Well, yeah, of course you're going to feel bad. All right, that's, just don't look at it that way, okay? Like, what I got to teach guys in my course, my Reforged Man course, is like, listen, when you relapse, that's a profound opportunity. It's a profound opportunity for you to go and analyze exactly what happened. What did you do? What was going on? What did you think that led to the relapse? Okay, we write all that out. And then we ask ourselves, well, if I was in that exact same situation again, what could I do differently to make sure that I get a different result? What could I do differently? What could I think differently? What kind of words do I want to feed myself? What sort of actions were available to me that would have, you know, addressed my underlying emotional issue or circumstantial challenge better than using porn? Okay. So practically speaking, like, you know, you're completely shooting yourself in the foot by not looking at areas where things are going wrong. Like, how could you ever expect things to improve if you're not analyzing and adjusting your approach, right? But we can take this even deeper, because really what's going on here is there's an identity issue. And this is a huge, huge piece, I think, of masculine development as a whole, probably, I mean, just human development as a whole, where if you've followed my stuff for a while, you're gonna be familiar with this, but it bears repeating. If you tie your sense of self to your performance, then you will always feel insecure, unless you're at those rare moments where you're, you know, on top of the world and really winning. But even if you have that situation where you're winning constantly, eventually that high wears off and that status is going to stop meaning so much to you. So when you tie your worth to your status, you're basically signing up for a roller coaster where when you do good and you get good results, you feel good. And when you underperform or you fail to get the results you're looking for, oh, you're going to feel bad. And so it's like this constant like, hey, down. And it's like, if you apply this to quitting porn, then you're going to relapse every time that you feel low status. You're going to, every single time you don't make the money you want, you get rejected, whatever. If you associate your worth with that status, all of a sudden, you're not worth the effort anymore because your status dropped, so your worth dropped. You stop being worth the effort of staying clean, treating yourself well, and then you pretty much just want to escape yourself. You want to escape the experience of being yourself, and that's what drives escapism, okay? So how do we fix this? How do we flip this? Well, you got to learn how to tap into your sense of dignity. You have to decouple your status from your worth. Your worth is something that's immutable. It's something that you can't change. You don't get better if you do good things. You don't get worse if you do bad things. Okay. Like, your fundamental worth, you have to view it as untouchable. It's unconditional. And when you can do this, you can look at your stats, whether it's your bank account, whether it's your rebooting streak, whatever, and you can see if it goes down, you can remind yourself, well, guess what? That doesn't define me. That doesn't define me. Just because I did poorly, that doesn't mean that I am bad. Yes, maybe that doesn't represent who I want to be. Yes, maybe that actually induces some pain, but it's not the pain of not being good. It's the pain of being at odds with the goodness I already have. Okay? And that sounds like maybe a semantic thing, but it's actually a very deeply psychological one that completely changes your experience of the issue. So, you know, mindset is a huge part of this. If you want to be able to if you want to be able to perform your best, you got to track the right things. You got to pay attention to the right numbers. Just that's just the way it works. But if you want to be able to do that without hating yourself in the process, you have to have a detachment from those numbers and realize they do not define you. No single fucking variable can define your worth and goodness as a man. And so the more tapped in you are into the unconditional worth that you have, the more objectively you can look at the results in front of you. In many ways, that's what a marker of mature masculinity is the ability to look soberly at the true measurable realities in your life and then not abandoning yourself if it's not what you want. Okay? It's you know, it can be challenging to do this. You know, a lot of guys, they've just been indoctrinated into this conditional worth mentality for forever. But if you undo this, you unlock an insane, insane amount of power to transform your life. So hopefully that helps clear up any resistance around this concept. If anyone's got any more issues, please feel free, drop a comment. And if it's a good one, I'll probably respond.
There we go. Right on. The next thing I wanted to get your take on was the real power of hip hop, according to Zuby. Let's check it out.
If on the flip side, you took a community and the things that are considered cool are doing drugs or selling drugs or having a criminal record or going to prison is considered cooler than going to university, having 5 children from 5 different women is considered cooler than having 5 children from 1 woman and so on, then you're going to get more people emulating that behavior. Again, especially young people who are most likely to be influenced. So I know that there are millions and millions of people who fall into different categories on this on all sides of the spectrum and across different races and ethnicities and nationalities and so on. But I think the real power of hip hop, the messaging, is its ability to shape and influence what is considered cool. And I think anyone who's a fan of hip hop actually knows how influential it can be, right? If you're a teenager and you're a rap fan, it's going to influence the way you dress, maybe the way you speak, the slang that you're using. It doesn't mean that you're going to go and imitate and mimic every single thing that you're hearing a rapper say on record. But I would absolutely be lying if I said that hip hop didn't have, like, of course hip hop had a massive influence on me.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting point, right?
The sulfur industry is worth nearly 30.
Autoplay. I think this is a really powerful thing to understand if you're a creator, is understanding that when you become a creator, when you become someone who is willing to put content out there, is that you are in some shape or form trying to shape the values of the people that you are interacting with. All right. Even if it's just in the confines of your own art, even if you're just writing fantasy novels, you are trying to create characters that people sympathize for in one direction or another. Right. It's like, are you having them cheer for a villain with low, moral character and value? Right. Or are you having them cheer for someone who is, admirable, someone that they can learn from? Right. And so I think it's cool that Zuby, has that attitude around this. And I think we gotta look at this. This is something that I've been thinking a lot about personally for a while in terms of like what kind of content am I feeding myself? Because as much as I would like to believe that I am, the master of my own psychological domain, the reality is like you can't escape the truism of like or the adage of you are what you eat. So if you consume a lot of lowbrow content that values things that actually aren't in alignment with your highest values, well, you're definitely not strengthening your highest values, okay? Now, the extent to which you are hurting them is debatable, but you're not strengthening them. So it's like if you're someone who is very interested in being a moral person, but you listen to music that primarily glorifies things that are very immoral, well, I mean, like, what's going on there? It's like, what do you think is going to happen to you yeah, you might just get a, you might get a pump, you might get a high from the music, from the lyrics and everything like that. But is that the kind of high that you want to train your brain to cultivate, right? So I've been slowly like scaling out a lot of content that doesn't really vibe with me morally, ethically, spiritually, even. You know, like I used to, I'm a fairly big metalhead, and I don't do the super satanic stuff anymore. I used to like not care. It's like, eh, who cares? You know, it's like, I can't even understand what they're saying. Cause like, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, after I thought about it, it's like, eh, what am I saying when I listen to this? You know, like, what am I unconsciously signing off on? And even if it's like a rather trivial thing, I had to come to terms with the fact that it doesn't necessarily make me feel in alignment. I'm not clicking on something that feels like it's reinforcing the man that I want to be. And so some of this kind of stuff, it might seem, you know, it's probably not top priority for a lot of people. There's probably other much bigger things to address in their life first. But if you're looking for really optimizing yourself, then you got to take into account opportunity costs. So it's like, for me, it's like, you know, if I'm listening to music every single day that does not morally align with who I want to be, or this is at least not, isn't even morally adjacent or ambiguous, it's outright counter to my morals, and I do that every day, you know, like that's, you know, 365 times where I'm clicking like, yes, I would like to be flooded with something that is completely contrary to the narrative that I want to play out in my life. And I got to think, well, what if I didn't do that? You know, I do a year of alternative clicks where I either put on some white noise or some music that is at least adjacent, or, you know, at least not contrary to what I value. Then what happens? I have to assume that there's going to be some beneficial boost from it. And so, yeah, man, like this is one of those things that it's a hard conversation to have, because I don't want to come across as like this like puritanical prude where it's like, yeah, don't listen to anything, blah, blah, blah. Cause like, I think there's a space to be able to artistically appreciate all different kinds of things. You know, like you could watch Breaking Bad and you can enjoy the show. You can think it's like an artistic, you know, wonderful thing, but you know, at the end of the day, what it's doing is focusing on the story of someone who chooses to become evil, really. And maybe it's worth it to do a few of those stories. But it seems like since that time period, you know, for me, just looking at like Breaking Bad, like I remember it was like Breaking Bad, Sopranos, what was that show? Boardwalk Empire. You know, I watched a lot of those kinds of things, and I just, you know, I got the message. It's like, oh yeah, if you live in a world without pursuing goodness and you just become selfish and seek power and that sort of thing, it's going to get violent. And yeah, maybe the story is interesting, but there's nothing soul affirming in there, at least for the most part. You know, there's always subplots and stuff where they have some good people and just getting shit on usually by the evil people in the stories. But I don't think I walk away empowered in any way. You know, at best, I walk away with some diversion. You know, I get to walk away appreciating some good writing, some good cinematography and things like that. But it's not something that I would say is lifting me up. And so you got to come to that point in your own life and figure out like what sort of content's going to serve you? What sort of music's going to serve you? What sort of narratives are you going to allow into your head? Because bottom line is, you don't need to allow everything in. You know, it's your job to curate your cognitive stream. And the more you optimize that for the kind of life you want to live, the kind of emotions you want to have, the kind of relationships you want to build, you know, the better all around you're going to be. So it's not a trivial question, but it's one that's I think it's one that's you do have to think about today, especially with just the level of production value and social interest and everything that goes into a lot of content that is just, in many ways, reprehensible. And you just got to figure out, it's like, is this really worth it? Is this really making your life better or not?
The next thing I wanted to show you is this clip where Destiny, the YouTuber, says that, quote, no college major is useless. Let's go ahead and check it out.
Do you agree that some majors are useless? I'm just curious.
No major is useless. Some majors don't make money, but mm-hmm. people talk about like useless majors, okay. like the only point of college is to make money.
Right.
Like,
it comes down to ROI.
When we talk about ROI, the return part there of that investment, the return can be cultural. We need art majors, we need history majors, we need English majors. It's an important part of having a functioning society. College shouldn't just be a jobs training program. There should be other things that we learn and we have like exemplified in society as well, I think.
Do you?
So I agree with his overall point, but then you attach a massive price tag to it, and you got to ask, is like, is that cultural gain worth that price tag? Is it worth particularly going into debt over? That's where I'm very questionable, where I question it a lot. Because with the way the internet is, you can learn all that stuff if you want to, right? And is there a lot of power and a lot of value in learning it in a structured environment where you have access to professors and things like that? Yeah, there is. You know, there's a lot of value in that. I like the liberal arts, when taught well, is incredibly, what do we want to call it? Like it really expands your horizons. I remember, for example, I took a writing course on Hemingway in college that completely transformed the way that I understood art. Because Hemingway, I just like, you know, would try and read his books in the same way that I would read like a regular fiction book, like a fantasy novel or something like that, like something more light. I'm like, oh, this sucks. But then I took this class on it and I realized that the way Hemingway writes is that it's kind of like the iceberg theory of literature, where he only gives you the tip of the iceberg in the writing. But what you can learn to do is you can learn to look at, okay, here's what he said, but what else does that imply? You know, what is he not saying? What is this, like, what is this little lot, like this character making this admission really mean on the psychological level, on the cultural level? And you realize, holy shit, this is deep as hell. There is so much more to this than what I, you know, picked up at first glance. And so that was incredibly powerful to see and to learn. But I don't know if investing, like going into massive debt, like hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt or tens of thousands of dollars in debt, is worth that lesson. You know, what I would rather see is greater sophistication in our common cultural art, right? Like going back to our conversation earlier about like, you know, the stuff that you consume, it's like you can get a liberal arts degree or the equivalent of it, I think, if you just have a good YouTube selection. You know, if you just watch good like history podcasts, you know, you watch some psychological channels, you watch some stuff that goes over the literary classics, you know, stuff on philosophy. There's so much free content out there. And, you know, heck, you could even buy a course. Okay. You could even join a cohort. Chances are like there's someone who's running a course out there on something that you're interested in, and you could probably get it for $100 or so, maybe a few $100, maybe even $1,000. All right, if you're really interested in something. But you know, we're not talking the tens of thousands of dollars that you're going to be spending on tuition. So it's I think the real like liberal arts thing, like in the past, it was like if you had the means and the finances, you could go to college and you could get really cultured. Arguably, you can still get that today. I would say it's arguable because it seems like the institutions are getting rather corrupted by a lot of the weird woke shit, and like all the best lessons aren't even being taught anymore, sadly. So it seems like that sophistication of character is now a voluntary thing that you have to take upon yourself, unless you just got money to burn and you can get yourself into a really good program.
All right, the next one I wanted to talk about is I found this great video on the problem with personal knowledge management systems like Notion, Obsidian. I know you use some apps like that. When I brought this up, though, it sounds like you know this guy, right?
Yeah, actually, Sam Matla. He's a buddy of mine. So it's hilarious that you stumbled across this on your own. I'll have to give him a shout out. But let's see what he has to say.
First of all, personal knowledge management makes you feel smart. The first time I used Drome Research and played around with bi-directional LinkedIn, I thought I'd found the meaning to life. I thought this will change everything. And as I added notes and added these bi-directional links between terms and concepts and words, I felt like a genius. I even looked down upon people who were still using peasant tools like Evernote and Apple Notes that didn't have this functionality. But it didn't take me long to realize that I actually wasn't doing better work. And that just because I felt smart, it didn't mean I was being smart or becoming smarter. The takeaway here before we move on is that creating complex systems for note taking makes you feel smart. Feeling smart is a good feeling, but just because it's a good feeling, it doesn't mean that we're doing good work or even doing work at all.
Yeah, he's got a great point. There is a very esoteric website called outlinersoftware.com. And I have spent a lot of time on that website, and it's for a bunch of other, it's for like knowledge workers, primarily for people who like to fiddle around with their knowledge management tools. And they have a term on that website called crimping, C-R-I-M-P. I forget what that stands for, but it basically just means fucking around with your knowledge management system instead of doing actual work, like switching all your notes from one platform to another, to another, to another. And I've definitely done that. You know, there was a period where I was like obsessive about this because I just felt overwhelmed with the amount of stuff that I had to do. And I just felt like, oh, the problem is my organizational system. And in part, it kind of was, but really it was down to two other things. It was that I was, well, a couple other things, three other things. It was like, I was trying to do too much. My systems were bad. And I just wasn't doing the work that would relieve my anxiety. And so, recognizing that, I knew that, okay, I had to become more rugged. I had to be willing to be in a state of more mess and disarray, and just do what I needed to do in that state of mess and disarray, while letting the systems kind of evolve over time. You know, it's like, if you got something that's good enough, great, roll with that. And then if you can find ways to make incremental improvements, fantastic. Eventually you'll have a clear picture. If you need to completely switch your system around, you can do it, right? And at that point, like, or at this point now, I've got like a really, you know, great system that I haven't really messed with for a couple of years, where prior to this I was, you know, constantly fiddling with shit. And in fact, if you're interested in seeing how I do it, I use the tool Obsidian, which is probably overkill for a lot of people. But me, as someone who writes a shit ton of stuff, you know, email a day, courses, I got to keep track of business, everything like that, is like, you know, the more complex system that you are working with, the more complex system you'll need to manage it. But like, still, the ultimate goal has to be around simplicity and execution. Because those things go hand in hand. It's like, the more simple your system, the more easy it is to execute on it, even if there is some manual labor involved. Like, for example, like something where it's like, people trying to make a super optimized system doesn't necessarily make it the most effective one. So like me, I will write out my daily to-do list every day. And the way I do that is by looking at my weekly to-do list. I don't worry about trying to figure out how I can make the weekly to-do list automatically populate my daily to-do list. You know, it's like, oh, I don't want to have to rewrite it. I shouldn't have to rewrite these tasks. But what I found is that manual step of looking at my weekly to-do list, which is just like, you know, a note or a document, and then peeling things off of it and putting it into my day, that actually loads it into my brain. All right, a lot of to-do lists, it's like you write out your weekly to-do list and then it'll automatically show up on your day each day. But when you show up and you look at that auto-generated to-do list, it's like you have no connection to what's on the page. And so it's like, in some ways, automation and sophistication works against you in the realm of knowledge management. And so, you know, I agree with Sam here. End of the day, you can't be chasing like that feeling of sophistication. You have to be looking at results, bottom line. And if you happen to be interested in my system for how I do manage my notes and to-dos and everything like that, you can check out the Self Mastery Club, which you can check out in the link below. And in there, I have my course, Man on Fire, where I show you how I set up my Obsidian tracker, which is I'm very, very happy with. But yeah, Sam's core point, right on.
All right, last but not least, I wanted to show you this clip of Jonathan Haidt on the Tim Ferriss Show discussing why he regrets not letting his son play Fortnite.
Let's check it out.
The one mistake I made was that when my son wanted Fortnite in sixth grade, and we said no, because video games can be addictive, But now that I've dug into the literature a lot more, now I see that, yes, a lot of boys do get in trouble from video games because they're on it so much. They're addicted to it, and it pushes out everything else. But a couple hours a day for boys to be in a group that's battling other boys, it turns out that's actually a good thing. And my son was somewhat cut off in sixth grade.
Good in what respects? How is that assessed? Just in terms of acting as a release valve for aggression or social cohesion?
Group dynamics. So the release valve idea from Freud does not end up being true. Kids don't need to blow off aggression. It's not like that. It's rather that girls and boys each need to practice their gendered behaviors. This is what play is. Play for all mammals is a way you practice in childhood the skills you'll need as an adult. And so boys and girls have very different play. Boys tend to break up into groups to compete with other groups. And multiplayer video games allow them to do that. So I'm not saying these are great. I'm saying ideally the kids should be out having adventures. But given that all the kids are home, they're not allowed out until they're 11, 12 years old. So at least a multiplayer video game allows them to be part of a group. Now, it's not a very creative group. The rules are all set by the company. So it's not like video games are anywhere near as good as being out on their own. But they're not bad until it gets to be heavy.
I think I agree with him. You know, it's like I had a lot of fun playing a bunch of video games as a kid. I played too many, for sure. But I also did spend a lot of time outdoors. I spent a ton of time building forts, playing basketball, you know, running around in the dark, pretending we were, you know, on missions and shit like that. And that was awesome. That's like, you know, that was incredibly, incredibly useful and powerful. But there's something unique about, like, he poo-poos video games as completely inferior to that, you know, spontaneous, free, creative play. And I don't think that's entirely true. It's just different. Because video games with their set rule sets, what they really teach is optimizing for a specific goal. Because that is its own specific skill set. And we will regularly be running into scenarios in real life where you're going to have some constraint. You're going to have some enforced, like, rule set. And you want to be able to be the guy who, quote unquote, breaks the meta. All right. Like in any kind of like online competitive game, there are some strategies that are going to be more popular than others. There are going to be some strategies that are more powerful. And this is what is called the meta or the meta game, which is, you know, I'm going to learn how to use this combination of positioning and weapons in Fortnite that is going to give me a completely unfair advantage over my, you know, the guys I'm fighting. And real life works this way. Right. And learning how to identify the meta and break it, you know, do a broken build in real life is essentially what we're all looking for. You're looking for that unfair competitive advantage. And people who are trained to look at that, to try and find that, to optimize around that, they're the people who are going to be doing that constantly. And the game of life is going to be constantly shifting metas. Like, you know, these competitive games, they actually what they do now is, like, you can't really fight the fact that there will always be some set of strategies that boils to the top. And to keep the game from getting stale, they'll go in and they'll tweak the variables. They'll make one gun less strong, or they'll change the layout of a map or something like that. And so all of a sudden there's this scramble to find the new meta. And that happens in real life all the time with technological innovation. It's like, you know, the internet broke the meta for marketing. And it's getting constantly broken by when, you know, different forms of advertising come in, different platforms come online, different strategies become available. Like, you know, now live, like, streaming media, us being able to do long form conversation is something there. That's a new thing. And eventually where there's going to be VR, there's going to be, you know, I'm going to be able to fire Pete finally, and I'm going to be able to have ChatGPT be my co-host. And, you know... You know, it's always going to be evolving. And if you're not willing to play that game of evolution or even look at it, then you're going to be behind. And so I do think video games help with that. And are there downsides to them? 100%. But there's definitely upsides as well. You just got to make sure that it's put in the right place. But if you're beyond, you know, being a kid, you really want to be focusing on playing the real game of life, right? That's what you want to be doing. You know, video games can't be your main thing anymore. It's like, you know, I'm out here playing my real game of life. I'm out here making a podcast. I'm out here trying to build a business. It's got its own meta to it in this digital landscape. And I'm trying to figure out how to get my unfair advantage. You know, same sort of thing that I was trying to do way back when I was a kid, trying to figure out how to, you know, get more headshots in Counter-Strike or whatever. So you know, be willing to define the value in these different things. And we're in a weird time where what's normal keeps getting shifted. And if you're willing to evolve along with it, keep stay on your feet, continue to think, you're going to be able to come out on top. So with that being said, if you're looking for some strategies to help you do that, make sure you check out the Self Mastery Club. Make sure you check out the training that I have below. The new, I guess, I don't know if the new training will be up by the time that this video is out. Maybe it will be. So make sure you check it out. And I'm going to help you get off porn. I'm going to help you find productivity. I'm going to help you become the man that you are meant to be. So make sure you check it out.
Awesome. Well, that's all I got for you guys this week. Thanks for hanging with us, guys.
Yep. Thanks for being here. Ooh, yeah. See you all in the next one.